That's Joe Newman leading off on a nifty little tune called Wednesday's Blues. It's a vintage number from his 1960 album, Jive at Five. Newman, also a composer and educator, performed with some of the big bands of his day, including Lionel Hampton's band and Count Basie's band and Benny Goodman's band. Born into a musical family in New Orleans, Newman created a musical family of his own. He founded Jazz Interactions, a nonprofit organization that promoted jazz in schools and colleges with jazz masterclasses. Later, he founded the Jazz Interaction Orchestra, for which he wrote music. He continued to tour until a serious stroke disabled him in 1991. He died the following year on July 4th at the age of 70. And we hear on this tune, not just Newman, of course, we hear Frank West on tenor sax, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Eddie Jones on bass, and Oliver Jackson on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, July the 30th, and we're talking about Obama's foreign policy, a riddle wrapped in a mystery, inside an enigma. 5 months after Britain officially declared war on Hitler's Germany for invading Poland, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, in an October the 1st, 1939 radio address, was unable to predict to anxious Britons what Russia would do. Russia, he said, was, quote, a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, unquote. That appears to be an apt description of U.S. foreign policy objectives and actions under President Barack Obama. At his lowest point of popularity since taking office in 2009, Obama's job approval rating has been hovering between 39% and 41% in national polls, disaffection with his handling of the economy a major factor. Disapproval of his foreign policy, however, is running at about 56%. We on Lead Stories discussed on July 7th and 8th Obama's downward spiral with an assessment of his administration's foreign policies. But our guest today helps us discuss it in even more detailed terms. He is scholar and prolific author, Dr. Gerald Horn, who teaches graduate courses in diplomatic history and is the John J. and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. I'm delighted that he's here with us.
I'm delighted too.
I hope you're delighted too, Gerald. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Does that phrase,
a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside of enigma, does it actually fit, in your opinion, Barack Obama's foreign policy objectives and actions?
Well, to a degree. I think that there are certain structural problems and impediments that President Obama faces that also have to be taken into account that soar far beyond his real and imagined weaknesses. I mean, look at this criminal aggression in Gaza right now. The U.S. Senate has voted unanimously to back Israel. The Congressional Black Caucus, which styles itself as the conscience of that legislative body, has been largely silent. It's difficult to think of one leading elected official in these United States of America who's spoken out against a criminal aggression that's driven people to the streets in Paris and London and Berlin and across the world. So if Mr. Obama were to speak out aggressively against Israel, this loose talk about his being impeached would suddenly and quickly become a reality, but perhaps even members of his own party leading the charge. So I think there is a basic structural problem in these United States of America. And you can say the same thing with regard to the Ukraine crisis. This crisis may be more dangerous, believe it or not, than the Gaza crisis, because what you're talking about, quite frankly, is trying to effectuate regime change in Moscow And Moscow is a leading nuclear power, and Moscow is very close to China and still wields significant influence at the United Nations at the Security Council. However, in the United States, there's such a backlog of anti-Moscow sentiment as a result of the lingering effects of the Cold War. Even if the current Democratic Party darling, Elizabeth Warren, were somehow to be catapulted into the Oval Office, she would probably be obliged to act similar to Mr. Obama, just as, for example, she has not been rather outspoken about Israeli aggression in Gaza. So I think that at times here in the United States of America, and perhaps understandably, we tend to personalize these issues because it's so formidable to think that the issue may go beyond the foibles of a particular individual and go to the foibles of a mass electorate, which changing that mass electorate's opinion, particularly the Euro-American segment, is more than a notion. So the United States faces this problem.
But, you know, to go back to this point that you're making about Israel, if there is any part of Obama's foreign policy that is absolutely clear, that is it. He has been absolutely clear about the United States' unwavering support of Israel, no matter what. So this is the one area in which he has not at all been cloudy or hesitant to define his policy. His policy is very, very, very clear.
But as you well know, that has not stopped rifts between the United States and Israel. We know that the relationship between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Mr. Obama is rather chilly. And it's not just a matter of a personality clash. I mean, there are fundamental clashes between Israel and the United States that even Mr. Obama's warm embrace of Israel cannot overcome. I mean, for example, there have been credible reports of Israel leaking U.S. military technology to China, for example. In Israel itself, part of what has driven this current criminal aggression is a split at the highest level of the Israeli leadership, a split that has, on the one hand, Mr. Netanyahu representing the hard right and his foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, representing the crazy right. In some ways, it reminds me of the split in the Republican Party in Washington between the so-called establishment Republicans and the so-called Tea Party Republicans. And given the fractiousness that you see in Israel, it's inevitable that that fractiousness is going to have ripple effect here in North America. That is to say that when Mr. Netanyahu chose the path of war, he was being pushed by the crazy right, and Mr. Obama, who has administering interests that go beyond the Middle East, as we call it, would inevitably be dragged into the maw. That is to say that Turkey and Qatar, two very important powers, have been quite critical of Israel. Mr. Obama has to try to maintain positive relations with Turkey since it's the eastern anchor of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and will be quite important if, heaven forbid, there is some sort of conflict with Moscow. And as is well known, the Arab countries pour a lot of the dollars they get from natural gas and petroleum back into the U.S. economy, not only Qatar, but Saudi Arabia, where you have nationals who are major investors in Apple Computer, Fox News, buy U.S. Treasury bills, which keep the U.S. government afloat. And so it's inevitable that there is going to be conflicting interests at a certain level between the United States and Israel, setting aside the power of the Israeli lobby, which has shown that it can flex its muscles and defeat political candidates who it objects to. And I would point to former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia as Exhibit A in that regard.
But let's go at the root of the problem. Does it not appear that this far into his second term in office, there isn't a, it doesn't seem, it doesn't feel like out of Washington we're getting a cogent kind of a clear picture of what just exactly what the United States foreign policy should be. What is the philosophy that's imbuing our foreign policy? And secondly, the Obama administration comes across as being very reactive as opposed to being ahead of problems, anticipating problems. Thirdly, we look at the primary agency of the foreign policy, the articulation of it coming out of first Hillary Rodham Clinton and now John Kerry, and they do not seem to be, they seem to be carrying out more of a personal take on what foreign policy should be, that they are actually shaping it as opposed to taking instruction from President Obama. These things add up to a feeling that the president really isn't calling the shots here, that there are entities within his administration that are pretty much doing their own thing or that are informing him as to what his foreign policy objectives ought to be.
Well, point number one is, I think that there is something to the point that Mr. Obama may not be in total control of foreign policy. I would say this is true for any Democratic Party president, because part of the problem structurally, once again, with U.S. politics is that the Democratic Party is heavily dependent upon black votes and, to a lesser degree, votes of Latinos. But because there is so much rancor, so much animosity, so much white supremacy, if you like, in these United States of America, particularly at the in the Republican Party, which is virtually an all-white party from top to bottom, that suggests that any Democratic Party president is not going to get the full support of what may be the most important sector in this body politic, which is the Euro-American vote across class lines. You know that in Mississippi and in Alabama, for example, routinely the white vote goes to the GOP at rates of 9-1. You know that in 1991, for example, the white vote went for governor David Duke, to vote for governor David Duke, who was a leading Klansman and Nazi, at a rate of 55%. So that's going to guarantee that a Democratic Party president either is going to have to ignore his base, as Mr. Obama has tended to do, or attack his base, as Bill Clinton did with his so-called welfare reform, the crime bill, and all the rest. And that trickles down into foreign policy. Secondly, any U.S. president, Democrat or Republican, really can't be forthcoming about foreign policy aims, because they can't come out and say that the purpose of foreign policy is to guarantee U.S. corporate and Wall Street hegemony. They have to dress up what's the real policy in a certain kind of gauzy rhetoric, which ultimately is misleading and ultimately is undermining. Third, Mr. Obama did set out certain principles, but they ran into structural impediments. For example, reset with Moscow, pivot towards Asia, meaning pivot towards China. The problem there is already enunciated, is that resetting relations with Moscow would be difficult at best, given the backlog of anti-Moscow sentiment, which is now bubbling to the surface. And in any case, it's going to be difficult to pivot towards China because the U.S. ruling elite is split on China. You have half of the ruling elite trying to participate in the gold rush to China, and the other half trying to overthrow the Communist Party leadership. And any class, even a U.S. ruling class, is going to have difficulty moving forward when it's not united. And they're certainly not united with regard to China. But having said all that, I would bow to your premise by suggesting that there was a fatal error by Mr. Obama. And I am speaking in personal terms. And what I'm speaking of is the 2011 NATO-led bombing, U.S.-led bombing of Libya. That has been a disaster. And it didn't have to happen because, if you recall, Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, the leading non-Democrat or Republican or independent voice in the administration, certainly a leading conservative voice, was against that particular intervention. But it was Hillary Rodham Clinton, Secretary of State, and Susan Rice, then U.N. Ambassador, and Samantha Power, present U.N. Ambassador, who clamored for it. We could digress and talk about why it is that the leading women members of the foreign policy establishment chose the route of war, and that's an issue well worth delving into because I think it'll be revelatory. But in any case, Mr. Obama could have hid behind Bob Gates's opposition and not gone to war, but he did not. And now it's turned out to be a disaster. It's not only the killing of U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens a couple years ago, which is going to bedevil Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. It's not just the fact that Libya, as we speak, is descending into chaos of a manner that the world has hardly seen in recent years, but it's primarily the fact that the chaos in Libya has spread outwards into neighboring Mali, where you may recall some months ago you had certain so-called religious extremists who took over the northern half of the country, which necessitated a French intervention and a United Nations intervention. That's had negative knock-on effects in neighboring Mali and neighboring Niger, and it spread into the continent's giant Nigeria, where the Boko Haram is on the rampage, most recently going over the border into Cameroon and kidnapping the wife of the vice premier of Cameroon, not to mention taking over towns throughout northern Nigeria. This could be even more disastrous than what you see unfolding in Libya, given the strength of the Nigerian economy, which current reports suggest is now the strongest economy on the African continent. And it's, quite frankly, disheartening and horrible and indicting that all of this happened on the administration, on the watch of the first U.S. president of African descent.
Well, the same president had early articulated something of a philosophy or perspective on what would come to be the benchmark of his foreign policy, which was that it was going to be smart foreign policy, meaning a combination of hard aid and soft aid, militarism and humanitarian aid combined. However, it still seems to be the case that the administration just did not know how to implement this smart policy. We see that it is in constantly in a position of being surprised by developments, constantly in a position of reacting, and constantly in a position of taking even contradictory positions. So it's ascending. It has sent so consistently this conflicting message as to where it stands or where it can be counted on to stand by the global community, that the United States no longer is in a position that it was in just a couple of years ago, literally seen as the, quote, leader of the world, which was what Barack Obama said, that his foreign policy would be demonstrated in terms of leadership and fostering leadership on the solution to issues. Do you think that he has actually implemented foreign policy in accordance with what he stated as his vision for foreign policy?
Well, the short answer is no. But once again, I think the reasons are complicated. To turn to a previous point, a base of Mr. Obama and the Democratic Party has been the black electorate. But as a result of a deal effectuated some decades ago that led to the erosion of Jim Crow, the deal basically suggested that black leaders would steer clear of foreign policy in return for anti-Jim Crow concessions. That led to the marginalizing, for example, of W.E.B. Du Bois, who was sacked from the NAACP for precisely speaking out on foreign policy and, in fact, was handcuffed and indicted for speaking out against nuclear weapons in the early 1950s. We all recall what happened to Martin Luther King after he spoke out strongly against the war in Vietnam. Not only did other civil rights leaders attack him, pretty soon he was lying in his grave. So the problem is that Mr. Obama cannot rely upon his base in order to propel his foreign policy, because his base either is silent on foreign policy. Look at the recent NAACP convention in Las Vegas. Do you recall any foreign policy pronouncements coming out of that very important meeting where hundreds, if not thousands, of black American leaders of various stripes huddled together? And that was not atypical, the fact that that organization has been largely silent on foreign policy. And then, of course, you have voices like yours and mine that are focal on foreign policy, but then the mainstream press would deem our voices to be a bit too strident and a bit too far to the left to incorporate. And so, therefore, that means that the White House is totally buffeted by winds from the right. Look at the crisis in Syria, for example, which in many ways is an exhibit of what I'm referring to. You had all of this clamor for the U.S. administration to fund the rebels who were trying to dislodge the Damascus-based regime, despite the fact that a significant percentage of the rebels are now helping to establish a so-called Islamic State in neighboring Iraq, which is going to basically make al-Qaeda's base in Afghanistan seem like a Girl Scout picnic by way of comparison. In other words, you have leading members of the foreign policy establishment who are speaking out of both sides of their mouth. They're saying support a certain faction in Syria, but oppose the faction across the border in Iraq. That's totally incoherent. And it's up to Mr. Obama to try to craft a coherent policy that takes into account this incoherent voice that is whispering incoherent messages in both ears. Then look at Afghanistan, for example. To a certain degree, that has been an inherited problem. We know that it's been one of the longest wars the United States has ever been involved in, from 2001 until today. Mr. Obama says that he wants to pull out troops. It doesn't take an oracle or a seer to suggest that as the U.S. troops begin to leave, the Taliban will begin to surge, and those surrounding Mr. Karzai, the present leader, or whoever will replace Mr. Karzai as a result of this recent hotly contested election, will sooner rather than later be on the next plane to Dubai in exile, and Taliban will be climbing back into power in Kabul, and the Washington Post editorial page will be denouncing Mr. Obama for his fecklessness and his alleged inability to administer U.S. foreign policy effectively. So these are just some of the issues that help to shed light on the very important question that you posed.
Well, I would tell you that this is a stunning revelation, too, that you have made about the importance of the black vote, which in turn should have empowered or should be empowering black leadership to participate and therefore influence, exert considerable influence on foreign policy. And the absence of African-Americans and Latinos, the foundation of the Democratic Party's base, the absence of that voice or these voices in the arena of foreign affairs is, in fact, a major contributor. That's an extraordinary insight, and I want to thank you for contributing that. That's an extraordinary insight right there. Now, let's take a look at where you see the major flubs of the Obama administration in terms of foreign affairs.
Well, let's return to what's really gotten this administration in the hot water, which is the revelations coming from former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. That is to say, the revelations that the personal mobile phone of Chancellor Angela Merkel was being surveilled and bugged by U.S. agents, or the fact that the equivalent of a congressional committee in Berlin that was investigating this outrage and this scandal was also being bugged and surveilled by the National Security Agency. That did not go down very well in Berlin. It didn't go down very well in Germany. It's helped to increase a rift between Berlin and Washington, and pressuring Berlin to up sanctions on Moscow when there are 6,000 German corporations profiting from investments in Russia and so many German workers who are employed by entities that profit from trade with Russia. This is deepening the rift between Berlin and Washington, and at the end of the day, may be one of the most significant developments out of this Obama administration. That is to say, the fact that there has arisen what might be called a new German question. The old German question, as evidenced by what happened in the first few decades of the 20th century, was German militarism. In the 21st century, we're faced, in a sense, with something that's opposite to that. Recall that Berlin chose not to participate in the 2011 misadventure in Libya. Another aspect of the Snowden revelations was surveillance of those at the highest level in Brazil. That led to President Dilma Rousseff canceling a visit to Washington. It's led to a chill in relations between the two giants of this hemisphere, Brazil and the United States of America. Keep in mind that even before these Snowden revelations, there was evidence to suggest that Brazil was seeking to stake out a position in this hemisphere, contrary to that laid out by Washington. Another flub, I might say, of this Obama administration was their failure to support a democratically elected regime in Honduras and basically giving the thumbs up to coup plotters who dislodged that regime. That has not only led directly to a flood of children from Honduras across the border into Texas and Southern California, but keep in mind that Brazil did not support that U.S. initiative on Honduras. They did not support the coup. Brazil is investing heavily in Cuba. The Obama administration has not measurably changed U.S. policy towards Cuba, which has been a flop and a failure for decades now. So I could go on in this vein, but I think you're beginning to see the drift of what I'm sketching.
Well, to what degree then is this, it appears that the policies, such as people are able to read them, not only have caused a great rift, but actually it has diminished severely the leverage that the United States used to have on the world scene, and in fact, I would contend, contributed to the emergence of new axes of power. In Central and South America, the United States no longer is a major player. They are forming their own economic groups, their own trade groups. They are leveraging the power that they have to basically organize themselves economically. And in terms of, some kind of a consortium that says that power now rests in Central and South America when it used to be completely U.S. hegemony in the hemisphere. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that you make a sound point, and I assume that what helped to animate that point you just made was a very important meeting that took place just days ago in Fortaleza, Brazil, where the BRICS nations met, referring to Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. These nations developed the so-called New Development Bank that's going to be challenging the hegemony of the World Bank, headquartered in Washington and by fiat, headed by a U.S. national. That is to say, there's a quota system that says that the World Bank must be headed by a U.S. national, even though when people of color, particularly black people, clamor for quotas, say, in higher education, we're told that it violates the principle of, quote, meritocracy, unquote. Somehow that does not come into play when U.S. imperial interests are at play. Likewise, at the BRICS meeting in Fortaleza, Brazil, there was the development of so-called contingency reserve arrangements, which are going to challenge the hegemony of the International Monetary Fund, headquartered in Washington, but by fiat, headed by Western European. Christine Lagarde of France is the present leader. Once again, it's a quota, which I had thought that those in the United States of America were opposed to, but I guess not when certain interests are at play. this was a very important development because it's challenging the hegemony of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which are two of the most powerful entities on this small planet. Part of the reason why the BRICS and nations were challenging these entities is because they have been reluctant to cede power to these rising powers, particularly China. You may recall that on April 30th, 2014, there was a very important headline in the Financial Times of London that suggested that by the end of the year, the Chinese economy would be more sizable than that of the United States of America, the first time since 1872 that the United States has not been adjudged to be the leading economy on this small planet. This is of enormous importance. But once again, it happens on Mr. Obama's watch, the rise of the BRICS, the rise of China, but it did not begin on Mr. Obama's watch, even though if you read some of the mainstream press, you would think all of the problems in the United States materialized magically in January 2009, which we know is worse than a fairy tale.
But, you know, one area which did occur and is occurring on President Obama's watch is his absolute unwillingness, I would say, to be kind, to engage in the African world. We do know that there are African leaders who will be assembling in Washington next month to have talks about, you know, bilateral aid and bilateral arrangements and trade and so forth. But it is unbelievable that this president, who certainly could have had a leg up in generating some kind of bilateral arrangements with Africa that did not exist before. And it's ironic that the most that we saw in terms of U.S.-Africa relations was under George Bush. What accounts for the president's disinterest, I should say, in engaging in if there's going to be a pivoting, Asia is not the only place to pivot toward. Why not Africa? Why his reluctance to engage with Africa?
Well, I think he has engaged, but part of the engagement has been unfortunate. I refer once again to the misadventure in Libya in 2011, which has had gigantic negative impact on the African continent and has won him few friends on the African continent. Second, the competition is very stiff right now. There's a whole spate of books coming out, some of which I've been reading, on China and Africa now. And it's very striking. I mean, it would be laughable if it were not so cynical, because the thrust of these books coming out from U.S. authors and a few European authors for the most part is wagging their fingers at the Africans, telling them to beware of the big bad wolf from Beijing. Now, this is coming from nations who have gotten fat and happy on the African slave trade, on colonialism directed towards Africa, on extracting natural resources from Africa for a pittance and a song. I mean, France has been a Dracula with regard to the African continent, sucking out the lifeblood, and basically its pretensions to being a major power basically rests upon its exploitation of Africa. And of course, France is a key ally, for the most part, of the United States of America. This meeting of African Union leaders that you're referring to is also going to reveal, it seems to me, another problem with U.S. foreign policy towards Africa, let alone Obama foreign policy towards Africa, which is, once again, that it's difficult for the United States to compete with regard to what Africans really want, which is, say, building of infrastructure, airports, highways, roads, hospitals, universities, et cetera. That's not what Mr. Obama is going to be talking about. Even if you look at, you mentioned former U.S. President George W. Bush and his policies towards HIV/AIDS, well, it would be well if Mr. Obama could follow through in that regard and perhaps even seek to increase biomedical assistance towards African leaders. For example, more research dollars of the National Institutes of Health poured into malaria, for example.
Or Ebola.
Or Ebola, for example. But I don't foresee that coming out of this meeting for a number of reasons. One, it was under the earlier President Bush, George H.W. Bush, who made that famous remark that the United States has more will than wallet. And given the economic crisis of 2008-2009, given the cascading problems that this country faces in terms of homelessness and hunger and a maniacal Tea Party caucus that's strangling policymaking in Washington, and given that overriding consideration, which is that a good deal of the electorate seems to go bananas if they think that U.S. tax dollars are going towards dark-skinned people, well, if you stir that up and pop it in the oven, it becomes clear why any U.S. president, even a president as farsighted and as intelligent and progressive as Utrecht Lee, would have difficulty in today's political environment.
I'm laughing because when Obama did go to Africa, I mean, when he finally decided that it was going to look really bad if he couldn't get there sooner, he decided to basically insult the African leaders by discussing not about the potential for trade and the interest in the United States in encouraging trade and so forth, but he instead talked about the need for these governments to get their act together to fight the corruption and basically to do the right thing in their own countries before they as a kind of precondition to doing business with the United States. So he really annoyed the African leaders themselves and found a wonderful way to insult them.
Well, I'm glad you raised that point, because that rhetorical strategy he deployed in Africa in many ways mirrors the rhetorical strategy he employs in Black America. That is to say, mm-hmm. we are the only community that he goes to and gives these moral lectures about pulling up your socks, for example, and getting your act together and all that. He doesn't go into Mexican-American communities and says that, for example. But I don't think that, once again, that's a personal flaw. There are political winds in the United States that impel U.S. leaders in that direction. And it takes a wise and a strong leader to resist those political winds. The problem is that when you go to Africa and employ that rhetorical strategy, not only does it win you few fans, but quite frankly, it's inimical to U.S. imperial interests, because all it does is drive more African leaders into the corner of Beijing, for example, or the BRICS, for example. And consider another aspect of policy towards Africa. It's no secret that the Zimbabwean leadership will not be invited to this meeting in Washington that will be unfolding shortly. It's no secret as well that one of the reasons why Zimbabwe is so unpopular in the United States of America, at least in Washington, official Washington, is that the leadership there expropriated land from European settlers, and that did not go down very well in a settler state such as the United States of America. And so if he had invited Mugabe, which of course would have pleased many African leaders, he would have outraged, enraged the impeachment caucus in Washington, which, as you know, is growing boundlessly with every passing day. So once again, there are these structural problems that helped to shed light on Obama foreign policy, combined, as I said, with unfortunate decisions. Foremost amongst those unfortunate decisions, once again, to reiterate, was the 2011 bombing campaign in Libya.
We're talking with Dr. Gerald Horn, who, as you know, is the author of more than 30 books, the most recent of them, Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. We had the pleasure of talking to him about these two books recently. We'll take questions at 888-874-4888 right after this very short break. We'll be right back. That's Joe Newman on trumpet, and the song is Wednesday's Blues. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. Our guest today, Professor Gerald Horn, again, the author of two recently incredibly powerful books, recently published incredible books, Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and The Counter-Revolution, 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. And we're talking about a foreign policy of the Obama administration, whether it's in fact a riddle wrapped in a side, an enigma, to borrow Winston Churchill's quote describing Russia at the dawn of World War II. Just as we are rating it, I just wanted to get a sense of you. Do you expect that the president in some way try to recoup the image that he has? And it's the media, you know, they're all saying unanimously that this president's foreign policy is down the toilet. Do you have the sense that he's a strong effort to Did we lose him? We had a little problem here getting information from the engineer that I'm breaking up. So I don't understand why, but sometimes these things happen. I'm in the bowels. Next, you're on the air with Gerald Horn.
Hello, Beatrice. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I wanted to just take a second to say that I am very grateful to have PRN and to have your show and at least a progressive outlet where we can hear people like Dr. Horn. And Dr. Horn, sir, I'm going to be buying your book later on today, your new book. I just had a comment pretty much, and maybe a question will fall in. I think it's shameful and disgusting that some of the progressive members of the Senate here on this recent vote couldn't even find their way to make even a comment off the record about this so-called war, which is really a slaughter going on in Gaza. I mean, people I'm talking about like Elizabeth Warren and Al Franken, and
but you ought to. I'm one question of our esteemed guest.
Yeah, I will. And I think I was going to say, you know, people like Barney Franken, people like that. But I think everyone listening, I would make a suggestion: just at least drop a note or email to your senators. I did with both of mine, and it may not do any good, but at least they'll hear that this is wrong. So I wanted. Excuse me?
Go ahead. Ask your question.
Yeah. I just was wondering also about Obama's foreign policy, which is, of course, discombobulated and confused in a lot of instances. Do you think that there are forces Namely, I mean, when you were going over the Libyan invasion, you brought up Hillary Clinton. And I think that there are forces in the Democratic Party that support the Clintons that don't like what happened in 2008. They're trying to sabotage this guy. Not that he doesn't have his own problems to begin with, but I believe that. What do you think about that?
Gerald?
I do think that there are conflicting interests at the highest levels of the Democratic Party. I'm not sure if the outgrowth of the 2008 primaries is the principal conflict. I mean, for example, we talked about U.S. policy towards Cuba. Let's say if the Obama administration chose to make policy towards Cuba more realistic, well, all hell would break loose, not least in the Democratic Party, where Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey, who, of course, is of Cuban extraction and is a leading hawk on Cuba, he would be in the front row calling for Mr. Obama's hide, not to mention the prospect that the Democrats could lose Florida, an important state, in the 2016 elections. Likewise, with regard to Israel and this criminal aggression, we've already made reference to the fact that the Israeli lobby is quite potent in Washington and across the country. So these are the structural problems that I think we have to address. And, you know, I'm not an opponent of Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. I think that she's made some fine proposals. But there seems to be this gathering feeling in certain precincts of the left that if you could just get Elizabeth Warren into the White House and get Obama out, then everything would be hunky-dory, pardon the expression. I think that that's naive at best.
Right.
Thanks so much, DX, for your call.
Bye-bye.
Chicago next. Henry, you're on the air with Gerald Horn.
Hey, how you doing, Utrecht?
Fine, thank you.
Honored to speak to you, Mr. Horn. I just finished your Counter-Revolution, the 1776 book. It's great. Very good.
Cool. Thank you.
Got a question. You were talking about how China will be the economic power or the sole economic power projected by, you know, next year. What do you think, or how long do you think their military power will be projected as number one? Because I see with the rising economy of China, their military shouldn't be too far behind. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a good question. Right now, the United States is the leading military power, and in terms of U.S. foreign policy, you can make a credible argument that the United States prefers to see diplomatic issues militarized because that plays to the strength of Washington and of the United States, which is the military. The United States is doing striking research, I might say, on robots, trying to develop what you could easily call robot soldiers, which obviously has some sort of implication, it seems, for the workforce, because we all already know that increasingly robots are replacing workers. The United States is doing very striking research with regard to, they're looking at birds who fly for days on end and trying to see if they could take that principle and apply it to human beings so that you could have human beings who could fight for days on end. I think that for some time to come, the United States is going to have the leading military in this world, and I don't envision China challenging the United States to that degree. However, as you know, the way warfare goes on now, right now, or even military threats goes on right now, it won't be necessary for China to spend as much on the military in order to counter the U.S. militarily.
Thank you very much, Henry from Chicago. From Washington, D.C., Mike, you're on the air with Gerald.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Your question, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Dr. Horn to kind of, if he could, elaborate on what I see as like a paradigm shift and a major transition that we're in the midst of. I know a lot of people are talking about the United States in terms of a nation state in a decline, but could Dr. Horn like kind of talk about how that whole nation state thing is kind of fading in the background, and really what we have going on is what Mussolini described as fascism on steroids. Like the corporations, the elites, the Fed, they've like taken over everything, and like the nations, it seems to me, don't really have, like, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on that we really don't, like, have privy to in terms of, you know, the intelligence community, what they're doing, the alternative economy, and all these different things that are being used against us. If you could just elaborate on some of those things, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, point number one is that certainly legally and constitutionally, the U.S. Supreme Court, with this ruling in the Citizens United cases, the Hobby Lobby case, they're increasingly saying that corporations have the same rights as people, as individuals. And it doesn't take a leap to suggest that ultimately the idea will be that corporate rights take precedence over human rights, and you can say that we're already there. Secondly, in order to meet this challenge from China, what you see is these so-called free trade talks taking place between the U.S. and the European Union. That is to say, a de facto merger between the Western European nations and the United States. But even that would only create a market of about 800 million, 300 million in the United States, 500 million in Western Europe. And that still is about half the size of China's 1.5, 1.6 billion. But at the same time, this free trade talks, they'll will be empowering corporations more. I mean, for example, already you have suggestions that if the U.S. wanted to move towards a public health care system, for example, and away from a health care system heavily based on private interests, that that could violate international accords and could be deemed to be illegal, for example. That bespeaks the point raised by the questioner, which is that increasingly the rights of corporations are taking precedence over the rights of human beings.
So,
if I can, sorry, Mike,
you have a follow-up?
Yes, I just wanted to ask him in terms of Pan-Africanism, in terms of how this impacts African people all over the planet and our desire to reunite or at least unify some of the majority of our people to try to act on one accord?
Well, I think that it has particularly negative impact on black people in the United States of America. I think we've had, speaking of paradigm shifts, one of the things that shifted is that some decades ago, one could be more optimistic about the destinies of black people in North America,
yeah.
given the
yeah.
fact that we were living in this advanced society. But increasingly, given the rise of the BRICS, with Brazil playing the leading role, has the largest black population outside of Nigeria, given the role of South Africa, which basically, I didn't mention, is going to be subsidized by the BRICS. That is to say that as a result of these arrangements that I made reference to, South Africa is kicking in $5 billion, but it can withdraw $10 billion, which hopefully then could be spread around its neighbors. What I'm trying to suggest to you is that increasingly the horizons are looking rather bright for African people outside of North America, but here, given the growth of the Tea Party, the growth of maniacal conservatism, the horizons seem to be dimming with every passing day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Well, that brings us to the end of our program, close to, with our very esteemed guest, Dr. Gerald Horn. I just wanted to ask, and this is not related to the subject, but it's related to your writing. What are you doing? How far are you along with your new book?
Well, I'm working on a number of books. I don't know if we have time to go into all of them, but let's just say that beginning in a few weeks, for about a year, I'll be writing 2 or 3 days a week, and I'll try to turn out a new biography of Paul Robeson, a new book on the Haitian Revolution, a new book on aviation, black Americans in aviation, a new book on the black press, and a new book on pro-Tokyo Negroes before World War II.
Wow. How is Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba during slavery and Jim Crow, the most recent? How is the book doing?
Oh, it's doing well, but it's not doing as well as the 1776 book, which is not surprising, since that book, as the title suggests, seeks to shake up the glorification narrative of the United States of America. And really, it ties into the conversations we've had this afternoon, because it seeks to underscore why the United States is such a conservative nation. And as a result, I think it's attracted more attention, because I think it's having more ripple impact than the Cuba book.
Well, I would recommend both. They are really extraordinary insights into a corner of history that we are completely, I should say, completely misled about. So it opens up an entirely new world, historically speaking, for us. Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba during slavery and Jim Crow, and the Counter-Revolution of 1776, slave resistance and the origins of the United States of America. Gerald Horn, thank you so much for being with us today and offering, as usual, extraordinary insights into the world of Obama's foreign policy.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. And we've come to the end of our program. So let me know how it resonates with you at leadstories@gmail.com, Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Keep it right here. Alternative Visions is next with Jack Rasmus. Thanks so much. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company.